We have Ned Farquhar from he's the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Land and Minerals Management at the U.S. Interior Department. He's here to provide a summary of the Department of Interior's Smart from the Start offshore wind initiative, including the Maine, Mass, and Rhode Island task force efforts to date. We welcome you, Ned. Take your time getting ready, and be sure to be sure to turn your microphone on when you're ready.
And Mr. Chairman, I heard somebody earlier say they thought refreshments would be a good idea at these meetings. I hope you don't need coffee at this presentation. So let me get started. My name is Ned Farquhar. I'm Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Land and Minerals Management, where I serve under Assistant Secretary Wilma A. Lewis. I appreciate the opportunity to appear today on behalf of the department, which is headed by Interior Secretary Ken Salazar. Secretary Salazar considers responsible development of offshore wind one of the keystones of the department's energy program. And as you know, President Obama is also enthusiastic about bringing renewable energy to market in a responsible fashion as well. I'm here today with two folks from our Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement, who actually do the work of implementing the renewable energy program, and they'll introduce themselves a little bit later and pick up on a little bit in the presentation. We appreciate the role that the fisheries industry plays in northeastern waters. We're somewhat constrained by the federal law, the Federal Advisory Committees Act, which I will discuss a little more later, in reaching out to non-governmental stakeholders for advice, and thus we take advantage of opportunities such as this one to provide information about our process and to respond to questions and comments. We also appreciate the role that Governor Carcheri and Governor Chafee have played in Rhode Island, and that Governor Patrick and his staff are playing in Massachusetts to make sure that the consideration of fisheries issues is given appropriate profile. The efforts that state-led task forces have played in these two states, as in other states along the Atlantic seaboard, are helpful and important. The approach taken by Massachusetts and Rhode Island has embodied cooperation, problem-solving, and a regional view, all of which are welcome and sensible features in a complicated process. State-led outreach is generating valuable information and generating more public awareness, involvement, and comments at this relatively early stage of considering offshore wind development, and this is a good thing. The recommended actions put forward by Massachusetts last week are sound and useful, and we are carefully considering them in hopes of responding relatively quickly, and we want to express our gratitude to those who participated in generating these recommendations. I should mention now before we start that the Cape Wind process is separate and different from what we are doing elsewhere on wind, because that proposal was submitted to the government before our department and the Bureau, known as BOEMER, were assigned jurisdiction over offshore renewable energy development in Congress's Energy Policy Act in 2005. In effect, Cape Wind was grandfathered by Congress under the older oversight system that was then in place, which did not include any regulations or process at our department. What we're doing now is somewhat less reactive to individual proposals generated by developers and more reflective, we believe, of general principles of coastal and marine planning, or CMSP. Overall, under this new process, which Secretary Salazar has dubbed Smart from the Start, we're trying to identify the best areas for considering wind development rather than responding to developers' proposals. Oops. There we go. Thank you. Oops. We received 268 comments on the Massachusetts Request for Interest, or RFI, for which the comment period closed about a week ago, NEMFC commented, and thank you for participating and making your views known. We anticipate that we will have all that input from this comment period accessible from the Bomer website pretty soon, and some of it's probably already up. Jessica Bradley from Bomer will discuss some of that input when she talks about the state-level intergovernmental task forces that Bomer has led. She will be followed by Brian Hooker, also from Bomer, who will talk about the environmental process associated with our consideration of future leasing and eventually development proposals. No one on this staff or in Bomer or in the department has made up their minds about future development in this area. We are still relatively early in the process, as I will explain in a minute. This is a great time for the NEFMC and people in the fisheries industries and other marine stakeholders to engage and be heard. I want to start by providing a general overview of the Atlantic wind development process. My main point in doing this is to say, as I just mentioned, that we are early in the process and it is working the way it should. It is getting people informed and involved, and it is helping us identify issues and potential geographies for proposed leasing and possible development. I'm glad to hear the way that fisheries issues are being discussed and brought forward so that we can continue the process of identifying potential wind development areas. Because of this, the rest of the process will be better informed and more likely to identify those best areas with the lowest conflict and the highest wind energy potential. We start with state-level governmental task forces, which include representatives from other federal agencies, from state government, from tribes, and from local government. Because they are not constituted under the FACA, the Federal Advisory Committees Act, they can't include non-governmental people, although we structure the meetings to try to allow some public feedback. Going through FACA takes a long time, and it creates a rigid structure that we can't adequately support in all the interested Atlantic states. We also gather significant public feedback in the public process with items like the RFI just issued for Massachusetts, calls for information, scoping and comment periods on environmental documents that will be related to leasing, site assessment, and development decisions, and on specific leasing proposals. These opportunities for public feedback are just starting now in the Northeast. RFIs and calls start the identification and consideration of specific wind energy areas where development might be appropriate. The task forces help identify these areas. Remember, the task forces should include vigorous, detailed input from governmental bodies about their areas of concern, issues such as fisheries, shipping, navigation, defense, security, habitat protection, marine mammals, and migratory birds, etc. By the time Bomer puts out a map in the context of an RFI or a call, the task force should have a general sense of major issues and concerns. Notably, this is not, at the RFI stage, a leasing proposal. It's the beginning of the process to determine where leasing would be appropriate in the RFI or call and whether it should be further considered. Oop. Looks like an animated. After we get public feedback on the RFI and or a call, we need to conduct appropriate environmental policy analysis under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, to decide whether or not we can proceed with leasing in the identified area. Often, as in the case of Massachusetts, we have learned issues that need to be considered in the environmental analysis and will affect the consideration of our leasing alternatives in the future. Usually, at this stage, the environmental analysis will start with an environmental assessment, or EA. We have a regional EA started up in the mid-Atlantic states, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, and New Jersey, looking at wind energy areas off those four states. The environmental analysis will consider whether we can proceed to authorize site assessment activities by potential developers, as well as offer leases. And this is an important point about the leases. The leases themselves will not convey immediate development rights. In fact, they will convey to the developer the right to pursue and propose a project subject to full environmental review when they develop a specific proposal. The reason we have to go at this in a staged process is that developers don't want to invest in a possible project without knowledge that the work they do studying the area and developing a proposal is protected and can't be used by someone else later in an open leasing process. In a sense, the development community has agreed that it considers security that a developer has the sole right to pursue and propose the project for the security that the project can actually be developed. Thus, they've taken on a significant amount of risk, and it's a different proposal and a different process from what BOEMER does to issue oil and gas leases, for instance, in the Gulf of Mexico, where most of the environmental work has been done prior to leasing, and the lease instrument itself conveys more probability of development. In Delaware, the state that is probably closest to issuance of leases, possibly by the end of this year, BOEMER went through a full process and found that there is only one qualified applicant, meaning there's no competitive interest in leasing. BOEMER is considering leasing in the regional Mid-Atlantic EA I just mentioned, which will go out to the public in draft in June, and which BOEMER could finalize in August of this year, allowing leasing in Delaware by the end of this year. A lessee, after receiving the lease, then goes to work on the Construction and Operations Plan, or COP. This can take a while because the developer has to design the project based on the site assessment permitted under the lease and the EA, and might have to do some basic environmental survey work as well as engineering for the site itself. All this information should be completed and presented in a comprehensive COP, which will then be subject to an environmental impact statement, or EIS. As everyone knows, the EIS process provides opportunities for public comment at least a couple of stages, scoping before preparation of the draft and comment on the draft EIS itself. This is when actual decisions about development will be made by BOEMER in consultation with other agencies and the interested public. So, just to go over it again, we want government involvement at the state-level task forces. We want to inform and involve the public and stakeholders early in the process, as we're doing now. We want to use the information gathered from the task forces, stakeholders, and the public to identify possible leasing areas for public consideration. We want to conduct appropriate environmental analysis and public review to support site assessment and leasing decisions. We want to propose leasing in a particular area based on that information, a stage we are not at yet in the Northeast, with public comment and involvement. When we issue a lease, we want it to signal the successful lessee that it's time to get out and do site assessment work and to begin preparing a proposed COP, again, considering issues that have been brought up so far and that might arise as we proceed through the EIS, the review of the project itself. We want to permit development only after a full public and agency review of the proposed project, which is still subject to revision or rejection even, based on the concerns and issues that could arise in the EIS or the other public processes around it. Only at that point can development occur, if approved in an appropriate record of decision informed by all this outreach, involvement, consultation, and information. Fisheries management councils are important stakeholders, and as much as you want to be involved in this process, we want to keep you involved and informed. BOEMER conducts all these activities in accordance with the Energy Policy Act of 2005, the law I mentioned earlier that transferred jurisdiction over the offshore renewable energy program to BOEMER. As you'll note on this slide, BOEMER also does oil and gas leasing according to a five-year plan that at this point does not include the Atlantic. And under terms of the EPACT, BOEMER must consider fisheries issues as well as navigation and sea lanes and other issues and uses. In the Atlantic states, BOEMER's jurisdiction begins 3 miles offshore outside state-managed waters and goes out to the 200-mile exclusive economic zone, or EEZ. Nationally, that would be about 1.7 billion acres that BOEMER oversees for potential energy development. I'd like to talk a little bit about why this is important at this point. I think there's been a lot of confusion about the process, so I wanted to go through that first. But let's talk a little bit about why we're interested in Atlantic wind. This resource is actually pretty darn amazing. As you can tell from this map, looking offshore and comparing the red ribbon offshore to the small dots of red and purple onshore, the offshore resource is more powerful, more plentiful, higher quality, and more dependable than onshore wind. It also, it could probably produce as many as 1,200 gigawatts of electric generating capacity, which is more than the nation's entire generating capacity right now. We don't anticipate anywhere near that much development, but I use that number to make sure people realize the value and volume of an important energy resource. Atlantic wind energy is also conveniently accessible to some of the nation's most concentrated population and demand markets, often in areas that don't have high-quality solar, geothermal, or onshore wind. Many of these Atlantic states also have renewable energy portfolio standards, greenhouse gas initiatives that require utilities to reduce their emissions of greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change. These are states that are hungry for renewable energy development. Secretary Salazar last year formed an Atlantic Offshore Wind Energy Consortium of interested governors, 11 of them, because of this high level of interest among the Atlantic states. Before initiating Smart from the Start, Secretary Salazar took some other important steps, resolving longstanding issues in a memorandum of understanding with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, getting decision-making on track for the Cape Wind project, which had been under consideration for almost a decade, and adopting the new regulatory framework essential for developers and stakeholders to understand the wind development process. And that implemented those EPACT statutory changes I mentioned earlier. What we're trying to do is identify the best areas for considering offshore wind development, collect information about them, and proceed with leasing as appropriate, and doing so in a process that won't take so long. It depends on early involvement of governmental stakeholders subject to the FACA considerations I mentioned earlier, and trying to include the basic principles of CMSP: stakeholder involvement, good data, and careful planning of activities on the OCS under the federal jurisdiction. Here's an example of some wind energy areas. There aren't any yet in the Northeast, so I'm showing the wind energy areas of the Mid-Atlantic region. These are under consideration. We already know in some areas that the areas will be reduced. In some, we don't know how much development interest there may be. In some, we are just starting to learn details about conflicts. Let me stress that identification of wind energy areas is not a final decision about which areas will be offered for lease or which may be eventually developed. Having identified these areas, we are able to ask governmental agencies, the public, and stakeholders to focus on them, bringing forward more details about other uses, other values, and science, instead of trying to study the whole Atlantic coast or reacting to proposals coming in from developers that might not be informed about potential conflicts and values. It's very important both to represent the important national security, environmental, shipping, and fishing interests in the government, and to try to make sure that potential developers know the process, issues, and people involved in the project review, for us to work closely with other federal agencies. We don't make decisions about leasing on our own. So BOMER has developed memoranda of understanding with Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Energy, and has reached out to make sure other key agencies such as Defense, Homeland Security, and the Coast Guard, the Corps, and NOAA are as involved and informed as possible. Thank you for your attention to my presentation. I look forward to your questions and comments. And now let me turn this over to Jessica, who will discuss the state-level task forces.
Thanks, Ned. Apologies for the any technical difficulties in the presentation. My name is Jessica Bradley, and I'm the project coordinator for the states of Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and New York. I work in the projects and coordination branch in the Office of Offshore Alternative Energy Programs at BOMER. And I'm going to be talking about the intergovernmental task forces and project coordination. So as Ned mentioned, BOMER has established these intergovernmental task forces to coordinate with affected state, local, and tribal governments as well as federal agencies. These task forces do not replace any consultation that's required by existing federal laws or regulations. It's really a forum for educating each other about the permitting and statutory responsibilities and stakeholder issues, exchange data and information about the offshore environment, and continue dialogue about renewable energy activities throughout the life of the leasing process. So the task forces don't end once a lease is issued. We consider the task force member input in all of the renewable energy leasing decisions. And again, as I mentioned earlier, the goal is really to promote efficient and effective decision making by increasing understanding of the regulatory processes, bringing together all of the interested and affected governmental parties to facilitate information sharing, discuss concerns and issues and solutions early in the process, and reduce multiple use conflicts, and also identify information gaps. And we believe that participation enables these governmental stakeholders to be proactive in our process rather than react to the proposals that we put out in front of them. And we have established task forces from Maine down to North Carolina, also in Oregon on the Pacific Coast. And on the horizon, we're looking at establishing task forces in Florida, Hawaii, and South Carolina. So I'm going to go through the New England states, beginning with Maine. We've had two task force meetings in Maine since the first meeting, or I guess beginning with the first meeting in September of 2010. And the first meeting of all of these task forces is really to get, it's a get-to-know-you meeting. It's to introduce the purpose of the task force and all of the members, discuss roles and responsibilities, explain the BOEMER renewable energy leasing process and also the environmental review process, and discuss the first step in that process, which is to develop a planning notice, so either a request for interest or a call for information. And that also includes identification of an area that you want to gather information about. So that was the first meeting in September of 2010 for Maine. The second meeting, the state's planning office presented information that they had gathered about the offshore environment in a maps and gaps presentation. So they also identified information that needed to be obtained before they could identify that area where they wanted to collect information about. So the next steps is really to identify that area where we want to gather the information and see if any developers are interested in consultation with the new governor and with the task force to, and also develop a notice, either a request for interest or a call for information to publish that in the Federal Register for public comment. And Massachusetts, we've held we've held four meetings over approximately 14 months before we published the request for interest. That was published in the Federal Register on December 29th, and the comment period was set to close, I think, February 28th. That comment period was reopened for an additional 30 days and closed just last Monday. As Ned mentioned, we received about 268 comments, about 270, I guess, including 11 expressions of interest from 10 different developers. So our next step internally is to go through those comments and come up with recommendations for winnowing down the area. Also, we need to go through the expressions of interest and determine if the developers are legally, technically, and financially qualified to move forward with their proposals and participate in our process. So once we kind of internally figure out what the comments are and determine qualifications, we will engage the task force, the Massachusetts task force, in a meeting and let them know what we received, and then identify the area, beginning with the larger area and then winnowing down to reduce those multiple use issues that were identified through these comments. That will also allow us to develop the call for information and nominations, which is the next step in the process. In Rhode Island, we held our first task force meeting back in November of 2009. The state of Rhode Island and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts identified an area offshore that they were both interested in. So They entered into negotiations and ended up signing, the two governors ended up signing a memorandum of understanding in July of last year, establishing this area of mutual interest that both states agreed to work collaboratively on for offshore development. In the, we received two separate unsolicited applications within the area of mutual interest, but in October and November of 2010. That kicked off a qualifications review process for the applicants, and then we also held a joint meeting of the Rhode Island and Massachusetts task forces in December to discuss the proposals and also to discuss next steps. We have a meeting scheduled on Monday, this upcoming Monday, May 2nd, and that will be to basically discuss the draft call for information and nominations, which is the area, it's an area that we're putting out in the Federal Register once we receive feedback from the task force. It's to gather information about the area and to solicit interest in the area. And in the Northeast, in New York, we have had one meeting back in November of 2010, basically introduced the purpose of the task force, discussed the members' roles and responsibilities. The state is initiating an offshore planning effort, and that is progressing right now. So we're working with the governor's office to identify next steps, but we assume that once their offshore planning effort is concluded, that it would result in some areas that they might be interested in to gather more information from the public. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Brian.
Thank you. My name is Brian Hooker, and I'm with the Environmental Review Branch within the Office of Alternative Energy Programs in BOEMER. Just wanted to kind of lead you through kind of part of the leasing and our environmental review process that is just getting started. Up on the screen there is the three stages of renewable energy leasing and development. One is the lease issuance and the site assessment activities. Under Smart from the Start, we're looking at the lease issuance and site assessment activities, especially right now in the Mid-Atlantic, and an environmental assessment that, as Ned mentioned, should be available for public comment in draft form in the near future. I want to stress that the third activity, the commercial activities, are still a ways away. We're not quite to the process of looking at commercial activities. So what you'll see in this environmental assessment is the environmental assessment of site assessment activities in the areas of the Mid-Atlantic. And once again, that process hasn't even begun yet in New England. That will be also coming in the near future after some of the task forces identify the wind energy areas. So as far as the leasing process goes, a leasing process may be initiated by the developer submitting an unsolicited request or by BOEMER, as we did in the Smart from the Start initiative, where we identified the wind energy areas and then solicited applications within those areas. In either case, BOEMER will issue public notices and determine whether the competitive interest exists, and then publish a request for information, as was done in Massachusetts, or call for information and nominations, in which we consider whether or not there's a competitive interest or a non-competitive interest in those areas. So as I mentioned, the first round that activities that we're going to be looking at are primarily just the site assessment activities. So I'm going to concentrate on what those activities are going to be. BOEMER has jurisdictional authority over wind resource assessment activities, primarily the installation of a meteorological tower or a meteorological buoy, and it's those installation activities that we're primarily looking at. However, secondarily, there are site characterization activities such as high-resolution surveys, biological resource surveys, cultural resource surveys, and other sub-bottom profiling that will go on during that we'll also evaluate. Just a quick example of the type of devices we're looking at. On the left there is the Cape Wind meteorological buoy, meteorological tower. And on the right is off New Jersey, that's a spar buoy. It's about 60 feet above the waterline, and it's a clump weight anchor type apparatus that they're using instead of constructing an actual meteorological tower and using LIDAR technology to assess the wind resource. As I said, under site characterization, there's several activities, primarily the high-resolution geophysical surveys, biological resource surveys, cultural resource surveys, and sub-bottom reconnaissance. As Jessica mentioned, we've received several comments, and a lot of those comments are regarding the collection of data to properly evaluate the areas. And as things stand now, we depend on the developer to collect a lot of that information during their site assessment activities that will then be made available prior to construction and operations when we actually do a full and complete EIS on the developer's activities. Just an example of some of the things that we will be looking at, more so in the on the broader level and in the any construction operations, multiple use conflicts, fisheries and fishing, as well as marine mammal, sea turtle, and seafloor habitat issues that may arise from construction operations. As you all are well aware of, we have several statutes that we consult under, primarily Magnuson for EFH and Endangered Species Act, and as well as MMPA and CZMA, among others. I just wanted to bring your attention to also we have a research and studies effort that that we have money allocated on an annual basis that we develop study development or study profiles and look at issues that are brought to our attention that need further study. So I just put the some of the resources there for to look at some of the studies that we have doing that are ongoing and that we're proposing in the near term. All that's available on our website. And quickly, I just wanted to just mention the comments we received on the Massachusetts RFI. As Jessica mentioned, it just closed last week. Approximately 270 responses. There were right now, it looks like there were about 11 fishery-specific comments that received, including comments from the council and NIMS, and several from commercial and recreational fishing interests. All those comments are processed both at kind of the BOMER project and coordination level and as well as the environmental review side before we actually begin drafting our environmental assessment for the areas being considered. All the comments will be posted at regulations.gov, and that link will be on our website as well. There are several opportunities for public comments. I'm sorry you can't really read it. In addition to all the formal opportunities for public comment through the Federal Register process, through the National Environmental Policy Act process, we've also participate and support a lot of the state-led stakeholder meetings. And we have some coming up in Massachusetts and Rhode Island in the very near future. We've already had several. As you're well aware, Massachusetts has had, I think, over 30 that we have participated in to some extent. I'll just leave it at that and leave our contact information for the Office of Alternative Energy Programs up there for you as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission. We'd love to engage in some answering questions and hearing comments and thoughts and trying to be as responsive as we can.
Okay, thank you to all three of you. I'll turn it over to the council. Any council members have questions or comments? Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that presentation. I hope I can phrase this correctly. The reference to some of the meetings with the states, at least I thought I heard you say that some states were interested in particular sites. My question is, who has the final authority as to who the quote, developer would be. Does the state play a part in that, or is that being done strictly at the federal level? I'm just curious about the, you know, the reference towards the particular states having interest in certain, you know, of the areas.
Thank you, sir. The Mr. Chairman, the lessee would be a federal lessee. So the states help choose the areas where the development might be, the leasing opportunity might be offered, and that lessee would then be a federal lessee. So the states are in a consultative and interactive mode, but the final transfer of a right to develop comes from the federal government. Do you guys want to add anything to that? Thank you.
If I might just follow up quickly, then, I mean, does the state have some ability to filter the decision for the developer?
Mr. Chairman, no, there's no way that the state can help select the developer formally in the leasing process. The decision would be according to whatever leasing methods we choose to implement, and obviously that could have some effect on who decides to participate and try to purchase a lease. But the states don't select the developers. Do you want to add to that? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Paul Howard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. We're not used to operating in the federal EEZ and having the so-called the states have jurisdiction in the EEZ. So it's a little bit different in looking at who. What we try to do is maximize the regional benefit. But what I see in the process that you're undertaking is a state-by-state benefit, state-by-state maximizing the benefits they'll achieve by activities in the EEZ. And when I look at it that way, I see fishing and the fishing industry receiving most of the burden instead of maybe maximizing the benefit by having maybe two or three wind farms in the EEZ. We might have seven, one for each state, two or three for Massachusetts or whatever, because of size. And that tends to maximize the input on one of the major stakeholders, fishing. So right now I don't see any benefit from this state-by-state singular focus on activities in the EEZ.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Howard, and I appreciate that comment. I think it's actually a pretty perceptive analysis because the states individually are seeking certain benefits that they perceive from wind development. It's very important in the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy Act process, when we look at these environmental assessments and these EISs to assess cumulative impacts that we can project. So that's one avenue for trying to make sure that we look at those impacts, not just on fisheries, but on any other use or value as well. But I think that's something the fisheries community can help our team work with so that we know those key fishing areas, those key habitat areas, et cetera, and at least try to site these facilities in places where they'll have the least impact we can. But I think your comment's a fair one that we are looking in some areas, for instance, in the Mid-Atlantic, we're doing a regional EA that will give us a sense of regional issues. We're going to try to do that even on the state-level EAs for a place like Rhode Island or a place like Massachusetts where we anticipate having separate EAs for each area. But we do need help doing that kind of cumulative impact analysis. Thank you.
Sally.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question about how the work of the Interior Department is coordinating with the National Ocean Council, especially with regard to the guiding principles that were adopted through the Interagency Task Force on Oceans with regard to marine spatial planning. How does SMART from the Start mesh with that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And The National Oceans Council is getting started on this very important national effort toward coastal and marine spatial planning, which the President called for. And I always get the numbers transposed, but I remember it, the executive order begins with 13. I think it's 547. We are in that executive order calls for the executive agencies such as the Interior Department and the Commerce Department to follow basically a plan we've all been working on together to implement some coastal marine spatial planning. We think that this, first, we are developing what we consider to be good relations, good communication, good cooperation with the other federal agencies who are involved in CMSP. Further, we think we're developing excellent information and an ability to look at projects in the federal offshore, working with a whole slew of stakeholders and interests. That is going to be very helpful when the regional planning bodies get up and going and are able to start actually going through the exercise of developing and adopting plans. So although we're ahead of the process of actually adopting plans, we think we're following principles of CMSP in the engagement with the other agencies, in the engagement with the public and the stakeholders, trying to develop the best scientific information we can. For instance, with NOAA, we're working on a multiple-use marine cadastre, which is a very broad effort to try to gather information about the marine, the offshore, in one place that's publicly accessible, that we can all share, that the public will be able to look at and understand and use, starting with that kind of scientific information and then moving over to decision-making as well. I know a lot of the federal agencies are feeling as though it's difficult for them to participate because they don't have as much staff and resources as they'd like. We're trying to work through this process in a way where we can engage them in the best fashion they can be engaged, and trying to make sure they know when decisions will be made so that we can reach out to them and meet with them however it's going to work for them. So until that full planning process of CMSP is up and going and is actually, we're actually seeing plans adopted, this is the best we can do. We consider it constructive and positive for CMSP, and we're going to observe those principles as much as we can. Jessica or Brian, do you want to add to that?
Well, I would just add that, looking forward, we're definitely going to be engaged as the regional planning bodies take shape. And I believe the head of our office up there is heading the coordination on the Mid-Atlantic regional planning body. So we're definitely going to be active, and as these regional planning bodies get established, and as Ned mentioned, we're trying to embrace as many of the principles as possible at this juncture.
So in the meantime, I'm sure you know there's been, just as this initiative has started up, there's been some frustration with just even understanding when meetings are taking place, how people can participate. And you mentioned a couple of times the limitations that FACA puts on the task forces. So recognizing those limitations, even though I don't fully understand why those limitations really prevent more active stakeholder engagement or opportunity for stakeholder engagement, can you talk about what plans you might have for providing additional opportunity for people to engage at whatever level, if it's at the state interagency task forces or providing information, being proactive in putting information out about when meetings are taking place rather than having people needing to go to your website to find out when they're taking place and pulling your website on a regular basis. Can you just talk more about how you're going to increase stakeholder engagement?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I might have not expressed that adequately about the FACA issues. I was just trying to say that the FACA itself can't include everybody who might be interested in the way of non-governmental people, but we are able, through all these other processes that both Jessica and Brian and I tried to lay out here, to offer a lot of opportunities for people to comment and get engaged. So we think there are a lot of opportunities along the way. At one point, and it depends whether it's a competitive or a non-competitive, et cetera, but I counted about 10 to 13 different places where there will be opportunities for people to be involved and see what's going on. In fact, it might get to some people a little repetitive because we are trying to start, as we did in Massachusetts, with a large area and hear people's ideas and then narrow down to what eventually makes sense for actual leasing. I think we're totally interested in hearing suggestions about how to improve our public outreach so people are more aware of what's going on, as you're suggesting. We've tried to develop email lists and such so that we're able to contact people. We have notices in different media, et cetera. These guys can probably describe some more of those outreach efforts. But if there are further ideas, we'd love to hear them. I think one thing for bodies like this, if you're interested, we're happy to come back whenever you're meeting and spend any time with you, either offline or online or on the phone or whatever it might be, talking about what's happening. So we're very interested in engaging that kind of public involvement, but you know, we can, I'm sure, always benefit from people's suggestions. Do you guys want to add any more ideas about how we get that involvement?
I just would say I think you touched upon the main ones. We have added the councils to our task force mailing list just recently, so email boxes will probably begin filling in the short term. Jessica, did you want to talk about the meetings?
Sure. Well, we've had several public information sessions that were hosted by the state of Rhode Island and also the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, specifically related to the Massachusetts request for interest and then off of Rhode Island, the process of developing the call for information and nominations. And what we committed to during those meetings is coming back at key points in our decision-making process and having similar public outreach and stakeholder meetings. We also are really encouraged by both states in setting up their Fisherman's Working Group, the Habitat Working Group in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and also the Fisheries Advisory Board that has yet to be set up in the state of Rhode Island. And we would continue to participate and provide support for those efforts as well.
Thank you. Two things. I would suggest that listserv makes a lot of sense. Even if you just have Karen Roy on the listserv, then you're going to be reaching everybody in this room with, you know, just with one email, because you know, the council's really good at turning around and getting information out. So you'd be hitting a lot of people that way. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I do have a few more questions. Thank you. A question about essential fish habitat designations. So the council has, there are existing habitat, essential fish habitat designations on the books. They have been since 1998. They're obviously very out of date. They were put together quickly to get the council in compliance with 1996 amendments to the Magnuson Act. The council's been working for years on updating the essential fish habitat designations. They're not yet on the books. They're all but approved. My question is to you, what kind of consideration can you give to the new but not yet published in regulation essential fish habitat designations in your consideration of where lease blocks may be made available?
I think we could definitely take them under consideration as part of our you know, NEPA review. I don't think the service would include them as of yet in their our consultation under the Magnuson-Stevens Act. but we could definitely, as part of a body of knowledge under our NEPA review, take those into consideration.
That is, we're not, in this process, we're not interested just in the, you know, the formally designated areas or something like that in any situation. I mean, it's the same with navigation. We have traffic separation systems and zones and such, and we're not saying the only thing we're going to look at is what the Coast Guard has mapped. You know, we need to know what the actual resources and uses and values are, whether or not they've been cataloged and codified in that way. So as much information as you've got like that, like Brian says, we'd love to have that in the process and be able to consider it. The general view, I think, should be that wind development probably can occur in some places, but it needs to be the right places. And we can't tell those places until we have that kind of information. And by the way, we do have a bullseye on Karen Roy for the listserv. Thank you, Karen.
How is the MOU with NOAA being developed? Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Mr. Chairman, we've been working with NOAA on a broad MOU about these energy development activities in the coastal zone or the federal offshore. I'm not certain about the status of that. I don't believe any of us are. I can get back to you with that. I've talked about it with Ms. Kirkle in the past, but that was the last time I checked in on it. Was probably mid-March, so I'm just not aware of where it stands right now. Pat, do you think you could add anything to that? Or
no, I'm not. I'm not aware of where it stands either.
So we'll try to get you more information. If I can get your contact info, or I can send it direct to Karen, and we'll answer that question. Thank you.
Okay. And one last question on the footprint of potential wind energy projects. How do you consider transmission lines? Because the wind energy areas in the Mid-Atlantic and the area south of Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket is just a block offshore. How do you consider that at this point in the process, or do you just not until there's an actual lease that's issued?
We need to, under NEPA, we need to consider associated actions and impacts. So we definitely need to look at the transmission that would be required for a generation project. Brian can answer better what we actually do.
Right. Just at this stage, the only thing we're looking at is the number of vessel trips as far as like the survey activity, and we include in our number of survey miles, you know, estimating the cable routes to shore. But as far as like where we are in our NEPA analysis, we're only looking at those site assessment activities, and there's nothing under site assessment activities that would involve actually constructing or, you know, disrupting habitat for cable laying. So that won't be evaluated until the construction and operations plan.
That's the end of my questions, and I would just say that during the executive committee meeting a few weeks ago, there was discussion about making available agenda time on full council meetings in the foreseeable future for someone from the Interior Department to come and brief on the progress that you're making, understanding that there's a strong push to make this happen relatively quickly. So even just a couple of months between the meetings that the council has, a lot can happen. So I hope that's something that the council will do to make available to the Interior Department. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, the coffee idea, too, because obviously we're not too exciting. But we do want to be here and engage with you and hear the issues and also answer questions and make sure people know where we are in the process. So anything like that that you would request from us, we'll make a very conscientious effort to comply. Thank you.
Terry, then Mary Beth.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your presentation. I just wanted to follow up on Paul's comment about dealing with the states, and strictly from the state of Maine's perspective, there's a huge benefit for you folks to deal with the state, particularly for this two very important species to us, lobster and shrimp, which are not regulated by this body, because certainly those fishermen are going to have a whole lot to say.
Mr. Chairman, very good suggestion. I know we're interested in that, and we'll be reaching out in those communities. Do you want to add to that, since you're both familiar with me?
I'll just say I have had some communication with the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, done a brief staff briefing for the staff there, and I hope to in the future also brief the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission in a similar manner.
Well, I mean, as was mentioned, there have been two meetings in Maine, but they've really been the circling dog approach. Without an interested developer at this point, the industry and the state are sort of at a point of an impasse.
Mr. Chairman, Maine also, I think, is going through a more exploratory process toward development, because they're looking at this deep water technology that hasn't really been used that much around the world yet, and they're really going through phases where they want to do smaller projects and test and see how they turn out. So as that begins to unfold, I think we'll see, you know, good substantive opportunities to engage with the fisheries community. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And you're going to be dealing with a new governor and a new administration that may or may not have different policies.
Yes, I've heard echoes of that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mary Beth, has your question not been asked?
It's not been asked. Okay. I was just hoping, I had a couple questions, one which was just sort of to clarify the process, which you went through pretty well. You put together a task force. It's sort of a process between you and states, and that particular group is then developing the area, and you would issue the RFI. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, that's pretty darn accurate.
Then after following, you know, you're receiving comments and that sort of thing, at some point you're going to develop an EA, and then when developers are identified and leases, they will do research on specific sites and then develop an EIS.
You got it.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, that's right.
And then I did notice in your presentation that you talked a lot about involving the public and that you would hope that it would be a proactive process instead of a reactive process. And I think in Massachusetts, what I've seen so far, I think the industry felt like we were in the reactive position instead of the proactive position. And I wondered if, and I think you probably noticed that as well, and I wondered if moving forward, if you have a plan that would sort of front load the public process a little bit more before issuing an RFI.
Mr. Chairman, we've already issued that Massachusetts RFI, so I don't see us using this experience necessarily to benefit us in the short term, because now we're in the process of narrowing down to actual areas that might be proposed for leasing. I thought Jessica did a good job of trying to make sure we captured for you the large number of meetings we've tried to go to with the state, for instance, where the state's held meetings and such. We've tried to reach out a little bit in the fisheries community, and we're ramping up on that as the process begins to gain a little more steam. So I think we have learned some lessons about how to do that, and we'll continue to try to find opportunities for it. The states, I think, and the commission play a very important role, because, you know, you represent those fisheries interests and you can engage people. You're local. You know who to talk to. You know who's concerned. And so we're going to continue to rely, I think, pretty heavily on the local advice and the local knowledge for making sure we make those types of contacts the right way. Jessica or Brian, do you want to add to that?
Well, I just think what Ms. Tooley was getting at was moving forward with, you know, future RFIs. Yes, we don't intend to be as reactive a situation. We, as Ms. McGee mentioned, you know, perhaps addressing the council on a regular basis so that, you know, prior to any RFI coming out, you'll be well aware of that development before it hits the streets in a Federal Register notice. So, no, moving forward, we will be very proactive in making sure that all stakeholders are informed.
And we don't have any plans right now for further RFIs that I'm aware of. Is that fair?
Well, Jessica, Brian, Ned, thank you. I'm going to ask if there's a couple of comments from the audience, if they can keep it brief. Then we'll move on to our next agenda item. I think if one of you could just maybe sit in the front row and provide space for the public. John Williamson.
It's John Williamson for Ocean Conservancy.
Am I too close? Yeah.
And the question specifically goes to the intent that has been expressed here today to make the wind power siting process incorporate some of the principles of coastal marine spatial planning. This council has put a great deal of importance on being in this, at the core of coastal marine spatial planning, as it's been proposed by the National Ocean Council and National Ocean Policy. And John and Paul have been real leaders in getting this council integrated with the NROC effort here in New England, Mid-Atlantic Council similarly with the MARCO effort in the Mid-Atlantic states. We understand that CMSP is going to involve a lot of data, bringing a lot of data in on fisheries and data in from other competing uses in the EEZ, and there will be a need to get all that data on the table and a lot of policy development, prioritization. There will be a need to identify trade-offs. There will be a need for a decision-making matrix, all to be developed in a planning process. The question that we have is, how will that prioritization, how will those gray areas be dealt with by BOMRE in wind power siting? So I have a specific question for our BOMRE friends, and that is, who is making the decisions on how to use all the data we have on fisheries and marine ecosystems in deciding where it's acceptable to have a wind power site and where it's not? What's the line that will be drawn, and how will that line be drawn?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The lease will actually be issued by BOMRE, but it will be after a process that includes a consultation that Brian put up on the screen there. So it's a very iterative process that includes a lot of considerations from other agencies as well. But the actual lease is issued by BOMRE.
I do understand that. Does that mean that the scientists who have been most integral with developing this information and all the analysis that's being done now by the Fisheries Science Center, mining 40 years worth of data for planning, will those scientists be part of your process?
Mr. Chairman, we've invited that kind of information forward. Where we know about it, we're going to actually go and try to find it and seek it out and have those people comment and be involved. So we hope that they will be involved and that their information will be considered in the process.
Well, it's one thing to consider information, but it's another thing to actually do the analysis. So the question is, will they be part of the final analysis process for deciding, well, it's more important to have wind power here and it's more important to protect fisheries or ecology here?
I'm going to let Brian answer that from the perspective of NEPA, sir.
Thank you.
as I think we talked when we were talking at the Mid-Atlantic Council meeting, we have the Environment Review Branch is made up of marine biologists, economists, oceanographers. So all the disciplines that go into it, they're the ones that will be, you know, doing the review from the NEPA side.
And that will be exclusively Bulmer scientists.
Yes.
Thank you.
Ron, then Harriet, and then I got to cut it off.
Ron Smolowitz, Fisheries Survival Fund. I have just a basic question. I'm just wondering why they're citing these so far offshore. It would seem to me from a wind perspective, from a construction cost, from a fishery interaction, from all the various angles, that these wind turbine areas should be within 3 to 12 miles of the beach. And I'm just wondering why they've proposed them so far offshore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The inshore zone tends to have more conflicts, believe it or not. They might not all be fisheries conflicts, but there's issues about migratory birds and marine mammals. There's issues about view sheds and such. So we're not actually proposing these areas for lease at this point, but the task forces pretty uniformly up and down the Atlantic coastline seem to be pushing a little bit farther out for a variety of reasons. And as the deep water technology develops, it might be that it continues to march farther out because that might – the limits right now are – I think it's about 60 meters is the maximum depth that they want to put a foundation in. And once you move to these anchored settings, you might be able to go out a little beyond that that depth.
Okay, I just want to basically say that I was told that birds were what the issue. I've asked for the scientific papers that document. I've spent 40 years of my life out there doing research in these areas. I've done bird watching. I do marine mammal work. I do sea turtle work. The numbers of birds and marine mammals get higher offshore. The areas are less studied. As far as viewscapes, you know, if we're worrying about somebody concerned that their view is going to be interrupted by wind turbines 6 to 12 miles offshore, we have to get our priorities straight. I don't think that's very smart from the start. And if we're talking about a monopole versus the impact of a moored array in deep water, I think the monopole will be the choice from any sort of, a moored array takes up so much square miles, it's absolutely mind-boggling. So I think I'm a pro-wind person. I own a wind turbine. I work as a consultant for the offshore wind industry. And what I see here is not smart. I see something that is not going to lead this country down a path of developing offshore wind. Thank you.
Thanks for the comment, and I hope people make those kind of comments formally during the comment periods on some of these different opportunities we've got. And on behalf of the Bulmer staff and myself, I'd like to just say we very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today and to engage with you. You're welcome to call individually or as a group or whatever anytime. We'll be as responsive as we can, and thank you very much.
We had one more comment, Harriet.
Harriet Diedrichson. I am completely vested in fishing and in the fisheries resource. And so I want to make a few comments. They're regurgitation of other people, professionals who have looked into the presentations that have been made by Bulmer and his comments. One of the first things, I question why the windmills even have to be in the ocean. To me, it's a bad choice. They could go on land. This group here is protecting the resource constantly. They're the trustees of the resource. And areas that were put up for bids are areas, some areas that have been closed or alternately closed. Okay, thank you. Alternately closed. So I question if fishing and fisheries is just going to be secondary to this new idea of wind that has never really been studied, perfected. 40% of what's happened in Europe is under litigation. That does not count the amount that was already scrapped before it ever got off the ground, and Holland is one of those countries that is fighting it right now. Also, we look at the scallop resource landing, just take the 45 million pounds, we'll multiply by 10 to make it easy, $450 million dockside without looking at, well, we multiply it to go out to the other people in the communities. That's a lot of money. That's something we know we have. Look at the article in Professional Mariner. Their last line states, remember, this is uncharted waters. They've already had to work out things in New Jersey because the trial windmills by that project there was going to be right in the shipping lane. They also stated what they've been put down in the Massachusetts section there, that first wind farm, right in the shipping lane. Are we going to zigzag all over the ocean is their question. The other thing that the Coast Guard with the radars, I have had a professional write a paper and submitted it with just basically on the radar issue. And they know there's going to be a problem with radars and the way people run, particularly people, all the boats. We're all basically fishing shorthanded, from the one who has one man on board, even to us who have seven men on board. The radar is going to have to be manned all the time if you're in those areas by a person who can really follow it consistently. The Coast Guard, in some of their paperwork, said, well, let it happen. We'll straighten it out later. I don't think the what's at risk of the fisheries resource is something that you should leave to be straightened out later. I understand there's a process, but just to be able to participate in a process, to say you have a process and that this is just going to be shoved along, I find offensive. And I sort of hear, it's what I hear, oh, it's going to happen, just where? Why not on land? To maintain this, I also understand these companies do not want to put up a decommission bond. Who's going to take care of it? Something in the ocean. We know it rusts. We're all involved here in fishing, and we know what it does. Also, from marine scientists, I understand that the windmills, their point is to take energy from the wind. When they take that energy from the wind, that can disrupt the natural wind and currents that have spread the larvae from scallops and fish to where they survive, perhaps moving them in areas where they'll die and you'll not get production. This is a great risk. I haven't heard this spoken about. Let me see what else I got here. Well, I think that's about the points I want to make, but specifically that last one on that redirection, perhaps, of wind. This is not something to be taken lightly, talking about there may be more employment. We know what we have, and we know that our resource has been managed very conservatively. We can get more money and more jobs from it. This is something that is out there that we don't know about, and I would expect this council to look very closely at it, since you're the trustees of the fisheries resource. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think we will carve out a space on every agenda moving forward for your office to send somebody to the council and update us on any developments through the RFI process or any other processes that are ongoing. And I appreciate your time and your presentation. And as you can see, we have some strong opinions here in this region. We're going to take a 15-minute break, and when we come back, we're going to tackle the last. 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 We're going to tackle.